18 of this year, NPR broadcast a report from Rob Stein saying a handful of scientists around the United States are trying to do something that some people find disturbing, to make embryos that are part human, part animal. He was complaining that the National Institutes of Health had imposed a moratorium on tax funding for research on this. But by the summer, the National Institutes of Health announced that it would support using our tax money for experiments in which human genetic material is combined with animals. Kathy Ostrowski of Kansan for Life wrote an article explaining, for decades, researchers have engaged in ethically non-controversial mixing of human and animal cells, such as growing human cancer tumors on mice to study disease processes. That's something that Matt Basil has been doing. He preached here a little while ago. Also ethically non-controversial are therapies that utilize animal tissue, for example, using a pig heart valve to replace a human heart valve. Stem cell research, however, which is what they're doing, trying to do now, is fundamentally different. Pluripotent stem cells can turn into any cell in the body. And when injected into an animal, as the new NIH proposals will allow, scientists don't know what kind of new species will result. UC Davis stem cell researcher Paul Knopfler told the New York Times, "We lack an understanding of at what point humanization of an animal brain could lead to more human-like thought or consciousness." This is just an illustration of the religious and moral implications of the principle of restraint in crossbreeding, which God gives us in Leviticus 19:19. Mixed seed fields, such as God prohibited to the Jews, were practiced as part of pagan religion by the Sabians. And you remember it was the enemy, the devil, that sowed the other seeds in the field in Jesus' parable, Matthew 13. Likewise, the wearing of the linsey-woolsey material appears to have been an Egyptian custom, as cited by the Jewish commentator Maimonides, as a practice of the pagan priests of Egypt. So by refusing to follow these particular practices, God's people were purposefully breaking identity with Egyptian, Canaanite, and satanic religious culture. And they're identifying with God's people instead. For us, this may not necessarily be a way of breaking identity with a pagan religious culture, but the principle still applies, that we are to be people who are identifying with God's culture rather than with the pagan concepts of religion, one of which is chaos. And that these are chaos sorts of ideas. The practices of pagans in suburban America may have little to do with seeds and cattle, but there are distinctive cultural traits which trace clearly to non-Christian ideology in our culture. And there's many of them. I could choose from many, and I don't have time to play this out much. But one example that comes to mind is background music. All your retail stores and restaurants play music in the background. Well, that music is promoting a certain worldview. Every piece of music has a message, even instrumental music. And the music that a store plays is going to be consistent with the worldview of its owner, what the owner is willing to allow. And that's why if you walk into a Chick-fil-A restaurant, you'll hear something radically different from any other fast food restaurant. Mr. Cathy chose to make a break with modern music and create a whole new genre of contemporary Christian instrumental music to play in his stores. This is just one example of making a break with a pagan concept and creating a new identity which is related to a faith in God. I'm not saying that Chick-fil-A is perfect, but here's an example of what one Christian has done. Are there other ways that you can show identity with God rather than with the culture around you? I believe this is also a principle that comes out of this verse. This also points to our salvation. A number of Bible commentaries, I didn't really think this was connected, but almost every Bible commentary I read mentioned this, so I'll mention it. Christ's righteousness is often compared to a garment, like it is in Revelation 19:8. The saints clothed in white linen, which is the righteousness of Christ. The Bible compares men's righteousness, our good deeds, to filthy rags. These two are incompatible with each other in salvation. Such who believe in Christ are justified by the obedience of the one, Jesus, and not of more than one. And by faith in that obedience and righteousness of Christ, apart from the works of the law, we are saved. To join together the righteousness of Christ and our own righteousness to consider ourselves right with God is needless, disagreeable, and dangerous, writes John Gill. So it even applies to our salvation. Be careful to keep distinct the things which God calls us to keep distinct. His righteousness is the only means of our salvation. Now, coming back to other practical things, does this mean you can't wear a blended T-shirt? Does this mean you can't breed mules? It seems like that this verse would speak against those things. Godly people like King David and King Solomon used mules. I don't think that this verse is about. I don't think that that's the heart of this verse. I think to simply, not wear two kinds of fabric or not have any hybrids, I don't think that is the heart of this verse. There may be instances where you can, make a hybrid or put some things together in a way that's faithful to God and in a way with an attitude of loving your neighbor. John Calvin wrote about this idea of this law as a guardrail principle. Not so when you build a guardrail, the guardrail isn't there because you want a guardrail, because you think guardrails look pretty, or because you don't want to go to the place where the guardrail is. The guardrail is there to keep you from going past that point. It's a training. It's a safety device, and that's the idea that John Calvin brought out in his commentary on this verse. He said this law was to keep God's people cultivating natural and simple habits, and that this discipline would curb them from sinking by degrees into the practices and customs of the heathen. It's not that planting different seeds is the end of the world. This law teaches us to move away in our heart attitude from the sins of despising God's handiwork, moving away in our heart attitude from focusing upon human innovation as the solution to the world's problems. It's like the guardrail that keeps us from driving off a cliff. It's a boundary of sorts, a fence. Good fences make good neighbors. And once again, we see that loving God and loving our neighbor go hand in glove. I'll stop at this point, and I'll try to find some more practical applications to other things that are covered in Leviticus 19. But just in conclusion, remember these principles that let us love God and love our neighbor by protecting our neighbor's life and reputation. Let us love God and love our neighbor by keeping our hearts open to them rather than bearing grudges, bearing love instead. And let us love God and love our neighbor by maintaining boundaries that value God's work, both in everyday life as well as spiritually.